everyone. I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hey, everyone. It's Brandon. Welcome back to another Turbo. I'd like to tell you a story today. This is about a patient I took care of a long time ago. This was about a 60-year-old male who had come to the hospital with chest pain, suggestive EKG findings, and was brought to the cath lab for a left heart cath, which showed a chronic total occlusion of the proximal LAD, or left main, which they did not intervene upon. Didn't feel like it was technically feasible. So the patient was brought back to the ICU and was treated medically and supportively, placed on heparin, received analgesia, and initially did okay. I took over his care on a night shift, at which point he was stable, just sitting around having some intermittent pains that at that point were, it was not even clear if they were cardiac. He'd been seen by other services like GI. He was getting some, pain medicine, some methicones, GI cocktails, things like that. I was called by the nurse to come see him and told that he had suddenly gone into asystole. He had been made a do not resuscitate previously, so no CPR was performed. But I came to the bedside and I did see a pulseless patient who had actually not a systole, but a ventricular standstill in the setting of a complete heart block. There were some P waves, but no ventricular response and no escape rhythm either. You know, in other settings, I would try to pace this patient. Pacing is something we've forgotten about in ACLS, but, you know, one potential cause of cardiac arrest could be a complete heart block and just total failure of the ventricles to offer any escape rhythm, and those patients should have a easy response to pacing. I think probably pacing in this setting counts as resuscitation, and he was do not resuscitate, so we just looked at him. And after almost 10 minutes, his heart started again. We kind of looked at each other, and we said, all right, I guess patient's got a pulse now. We'll try to resuscitate him. So I started him on some inotropes to try to chemically maintain really dromotropy, you know, conduction through that AV node. And on reflection, really felt like this must have been progression of that underlying infarct, you know, now involving the AV node. And it was not clear what to do because the patient didn't seem to have a lesion that can be intervened on and was now essentially peri-arrest. So he was unconscious. I spoke to his family and really told them that he was probably dying. And without more aggressive measures, using things like electricity and breathing tubes, there wasn't really much I could do to escalate his care. And they said, we're coming in there. Keep him alive until we get there. If that means you need to do these other things, like intubate him or do CPR or whatever, that's okay. We're going to make him comfort measures, but we'd like to be there before he dies. So that was an awkward situation for me because while they had essentially reversed his DNR, I still didn't really want to do these aggressive things because it wasn't really consistent with his goals of care. You know, it was a temporizing measure or means to an end, and if we had to, we would have, but I hoped to avoid it. And really, most of all, because most of those things I thought would render him unconscious, and by now he was actually starting to wake up. And if the family wanted to see him, I hoped that he could be awake for that, rather than perhaps sedated on a ventilator. So we just sat with him, and as he woke up, he was conscious, but he was confused. He kept asking where we were, who we were. He asked several times for his wife, who had died a number of years before. And he started to complain more and more about pain, pain in his chest, and just a sense of impending doom, as the textbooks say. He could feel that something was wrong. We don't see this a lot anymore. Of course, most acute myocardial ischemia we treat. We don't let a lot of infarcts just complete themselves anymore. And honestly, patients who are this sick tend to not be conscious and conversant, right? They're often sedated, intubated, and so on. So this was a little more like the situation you see in movies, where people die awake and talking to you and looking you in the eye. As he started to feel more pain and discomfort, I felt more and more wrong to not treat it, but you know, I still hoped to not accelerate his decompensation and keep him awake. So I started to offer him minute amounts of analgesia and sedation, and I would just give him little aliquots of ketamine by IV push. You know, typically for analgesia, I might use something like 20 milligrams of ketamine. Here, because he was in so much shock, and we were on just escalating amounts of vasopressors at this point. And he was hypotensive and bradycardic still, but still awake. I would give him like 2 milligrams of ketamine, 1 milligram. I think I gave him half a milligram at one point. And that helped. It took the edge off. At some point, he started to feel a little bit funny from it, which, of course, is the challenge with ketamine. You can have some kind of partially dissociative effects. But it helped and didn't seem to decompensate him. But he just kept feeling worse and worse. And I just sat here with this older gentleman holding his hand and trying to reassure him, because there was not a whole lot more that I could offer him. Until finally his family started to show up, and this was probably almost an hour after I called them. I think they live far away. And, you know, at that point, the plan from them was to wait for more family. And this dragged out for a while because there were quite a number of them who hoped to be there, and they kind of kept turning up. And over the next several hours, and there must have been 15 people who eventually arrived in this room. And at that point, you know, I kind of said, yes, everyone seems to be here, and I really think we need to more aggressively treat his symptoms. So I think we started him on some things like morphine, and eventually his heart stopped again. It was a case that affected me, and I think it's because of what I said. We don't often get to see patients at the end of their life who are so interactive, able to speak with you, engage with you, able to kind of demonstrate their humanity. We're often able to retreat a little bit and look at them more like a project or a medical challenge, really kind of a body in a bed. We're just reducing them to physiology. You know, and then you turn around and you see that their family has posted some photos of them on the wall and, you know, written that they hope to see him home soon. And it kind of reminds you that before they were a patient, they were a person. And having a patient who was awake, and because of the particular limitations on his care, had to remain in that state really right up to his death, was a strange reminder that we are treating humans. And so it was difficult. I think that barrier is often a defense for us. You know, we see so many patients who are sick and dying and who in fact die, that if we understood them all to be people, I think that would be really difficult for us to see most of them as projects, and maybe only occasionally see them as something more. Probably helps us, you know, with our longevity and the jobs we do. But sometimes they get you. I think it's the cases that are a little out of the ordinary, perhaps in reminding us more of ourselves. You know, if we are younger and the patient is very elderly, it's hard to identify too much with them. Of course, we eventually will be elderly, but it's often hard to really appreciate that. Maybe a patient who has some other things in common with us, the same name, they're from the same town. Maybe you even knew them even remotely before they were a patient. Or maybe they're younger and healthier. Maybe it's a patient who's the same age as you. And you start to be able to look at this person in the bed and think, that could be me. Then I think it's difficult. What do we do in these cases? Well, there's nothing to do, of course. Treat them as best we can. I think there is a right dose of this. I think it's not good to treat every patient, even just in our own minds, as something that's inhuman, because then we're just sort of mechanics. And while there's a lot of interesting things in that role, I don't think the job is good enough if that's all we're doing. We have to, on some level, remember that we're taking care of people. But there's also such a thing as an overdose. For all the reasons I said, we are not able to save all of those people. So we need to have a little bit of doublethink and be able to reduce many of them to just another case, while also remembering, you know, preferably in those with good outcomes, that we're having an impact on people's lives. I don't have another solution to all this, other than to say that some cases will be harder. But this one came to mind recently, and I wanted to share it with you. If you guys have any thoughts on that, or maybe a case you wanted to share, please feel free to reach out. And I'll talk to you guys next time.